over the rivers. "Blackfish," he said. "Has he wed yet? Taking some girl to wife?" Even on his deathbed, Catlin thought sadly. "He has not wed. You know that, father. Nor will he ever."
"I told him, commanded him, marry. I was his lord, he knows. My right to make his match. A good match. A red wine. Old house, sweet girl. Pretty. Freckles. Bethany, yes. Poor child. Still waiting. Yes, still."
"Bethany Redwine wed Lord Rowan years ago," Catlin reminded him. "She has 3 children by him."
"Even so,"
Lord Huster muttered.
"Even so, spit on the girl, the Redwines. Spit on me. His lord, his brother, that Blackfish. I had other offers. Lord Brecken's girl, Wald de Frey. Any of 3, he said. Has he wed? Anyone? Anyone?"
"No one," Catlin said. "Yet he has come many leagues to see you, fighting his way back to River Run. I would not be here now if Sir Brynden had not helped us."
"He was ever a warrior,"
her father husked.
"That he could do. Knights of the gate, yes."
He leaned back and closed his eyes, inutterably weary.
"Send him later. I'll sleep now. Too sick to fight. Send him up later. The Blackfish."
Catlin kissed him gently, smoothed his hair, and left him there, in the shade of his keep, with his rivers flowing beneath. He was asleep before she left the Solar. When she returned to the Lower Bailey, Sir Brynden Tully stood on the water stair with wet boots, talking with the captain of River Run's guards. He came to her at once. "Is he—" "Dying," she said, "as we feared." Her uncle's craggy face showed his pain, plain. He ran his fingers through his thick grey hair. "Will he see me?" She nodded. "He says he's too sick to fight." Brynden Blackfish chuckled. "I'm too old a soldier to believe that. Huster will be chiding me about that red wine girl, even as we light his funeral pyre, damn his bones." Catlin smiled, knowing it was true. "I do not see Rob. He went with Greyjoy to the hall, I believe." Theon Greyjoy was seated on a bench in River Run's great hall, enjoying a horn of ale and regaling her father's garrison with an account of the slaughter in the Whispering Woods.
"Some tried to flee, but we pinched the valley shot at both ends, and we rode out of the darkness with sword and lance. The Lannisters must have thought the others themselves were on them when that wolf of Rob's got in among them. I saw him tear one man's arm from his shoulder, and their horses went mad at the scent of him. I couldn't tell you how many men were thrown."
"Theon," she interrupted, "where might I find my son?"
"Lord Rob went to visit the Guardswood, milady."
It was what Ned would have done. "He is his father's son, as much as mine, I must remember.
Oh, Guards, Ned."
She found Rob beneath a green canopy of leaves, surrounded by tall redwoods and great old elms, kneeling before the heart tree. A slender weirwood, with a face more sad than fierce. His long sword was before him, the point thrust in the earth, his gloved hands clasped around the hilt. Around him others knelt: Grey John Umber, Rickard Carstark, Mage Mormont, Gorbert Glover, and more. Even Titus Blackwood was among them. The great raven cloak fanned out behind him. "These are the ones who keep the old guards," she realized. She asked herself what guard she kept these days, and could not find an answer. It would not do to disturb them at their prayers. The guards must have their due, even cruel guards who would take Ned from her, and her lord father as well. So Catelyn waited. The river wind moved through the high branches, and she could see the wheel tower to her right, ivy crawling up its side. As she stood there, all the memories came flooding back to her. Her father had taught her to ride among these trees, and that was the elm that Edmure had fallen from when he broke his arm. And over there, beneath that bower, she and Lysa had played at kissing with Pataya. She had not thought of that in years. How young they had all been. She no older than Sansa, Lysa younger than Arya, and Pataya younger still, yet eager. The girls had traded him between them, serious and giggling by turns. It came back to her so vividly she could almost feel his sweaty fingers on her shoulders and taste the mint on his breath. There was always mint growing in the Godswood, and Pataya had liked to chew it. He'd been such a bold little boy, always in trouble.
"He tried to put his tongue in my mouth," Catelyn had confessed to her sister afterwards when they were alone. "He did it with me too," Lysa had whispered, shy and breathless. "I liked it."
Rob got to his feet slowly and sheathed his sword, and Catelyn found herself wondering whether her son had ever kissed a girl in the God's Wood. Surely he must have. She had seen Jane Poole giving him moist-eyed glances, and some of the serving girls, even ones as old as 18. He had ridden in battle and killed men with a sword. Surely he had been kissed. There were tears in her eyes. She wiped them away, angrily. "Mother," Rob said when he saw her standing there, "we must call a council. There are things to be decided." "Your grandfather would like to see you," she said. "Rob, he's very sick." "Sir Edmure, tell me. I'm sorry, Mother, for Lord Huster and for you, yet first we must meet. We've had word from the south. Renly Baratheon has claimed his brother's crown."
"Renly?"
she said, shocked. "I had thought, surely it would be Lord Stannis."
"So did we all, my lady," Galbert Glover said. The war council convened in the great hall, at four long trestle tables arranged in a broken square. Lord Huster was too weak to attend, asleep on his balcony, dreaming of the sun on the rivers of his youth. Edmure sat in the high seat of the Tullys, with Brynden Blackfish at his side, and his father's bannermen arrayed to right and left and along the side tables. Word of the victory at River Run had spread to the fugitive lords of the Trident, drawing them back. Carol Vance came in, a lord now, his father dead beneath the Golden Tooth. Sir Mark Piper was with him, and they brought a Derry, Sir Raymond's son, a lad no older than Bran. Lord Jonas Bracken arrived from the ruins of Stonehenge, glowering and blustering, and took a seat as far from Titus Blackwood as the tables would permit. The northern lord sat opposite, with Catelyn and Rob facing her brother across the tables. They were fewer. The great John sat at Rob's left hand, and then Theon Greyjoy, Galbert Glover, and Lady Mormont were to the right of Catelyn. Lord Rickard Carstark, gaunt and hollow-eyed in his grief, took his seat like a man in a nightmare, his long beard uncombed and unwashed. He had left two sons dead in the Whispering Wood, and there was no word of the third, his eldest, who had led the Carstark spears against Tywin Lannister on the Green Fork. The arguing raged on late into the night. Each lord had a right to speak, and speak they did, and shout, and curse, and reason, and cajole, and jest, and bargain, and slam tankards on the table, and threaten, and walk out, and return sullen or smiling. Catelyn sat and listened to it all. Roose Bolton had reformed the battered remnants of their other host at the mouth of the causeway.
Sir Helmund Tallheart and Walder Frey still held the twins. Lord Tywin's army had crossed the Trident and was making for Harrenhal, and there were two kings in the realm. Two kings and no agreement. Many of the Lord's bannermen wanted to march on Harrenhal at once, to meet Lord Tywin and end Lannister power for all time. Young, hot-tempered Mark Piper urged a strike west, at Casterly Rock instead. Still others counselled patience. Riverrun sat athwart the Lannister supply lines, Jason Mallister pointed out. Let them bide their time, denying Lord Tywin fresh levies and provisions while they strengthened their defences and rested their weary troops. Lord Blackwood would have none of it. They should finish the work they began in the Whispering Wood, march to Harrenhal, and bring Roose Bolton's army down as well. What Blackwood urged, Bracken opposed, as ever. Lord Jonas Bracken rose to insist they ought to pledge their fealty to King Renly, and move south to join their might to his.
"Renly is not the king," Rob said. It was the first time her son had spoken. Like his father, he knew how to listen. "You cannot mean to hold to Joffrey, my lord," Galbert Glover said. "He put your father to death." "That makes him evil," Rob replied. "I do not know that it makes Renly king. Joffrey is still Robert's eldest true-born son, so the throne is rightfully his by all the laws of the realm. Were he to die, and I mean to see that he does, he has a younger brother. Tommen is next in line after Joffrey."
"Tommen is no less a Lannister," Sir Mark Piper snapped.
"As you say," said Rob, troubled. "Yet if neither one is king, still how could it be Lord Renly? He's Robert's younger brother. Bran can't be Lord of Winterfell before me, and Renly can't be king before Lord Stannis."
Lady Mormont agreed. "Lord Stannis has the better claim."
"Renly is crowned," said Mark Piper. "Highgarden and Storm's End support his claim, and the Dornishmen will not be laggardly. If Winterfell and Riverrun add their strength to his, he will have 5 of the 7 great houses behind him. 6, if the Aerons bestir themselves. 6 against the Rock. My lords, within the year, we will have all their heads on pikes, the Queen and the Boy King, Lord Tywin the Imp, the Kingslayer, Sir Kevin, all of them. That is what we shall win if we join with King Renly. What does Lord Stannis have against that, that we should cast it all aside?"
"The right," said Rob stubbornly. Catelyn thought he sounded eerily like his father as he said it.
"So you mean us to declare for Stannis?" said Edmure.
"I don't know," said Rob. "I prayed to know what to do, but the gods did not answer. The Lannisters killed my father for a traitor, and we know that was a lie. But if Joffrey is the lawful king, and we fight against him, we will be traitors."
"My lord father would urge caution," aged Sir Stevron said, with a weaselly smile of a fray. "Wait, let these two kings play their game of thrones. When they are done fighting, we shall bend our knee to the victor or oppose him, as we choose. With Renly arming, likely Lord Tywin would welcome a truce and the safe return of his son. Noble lords, allow me to go to him to Harrenhal and arrange good terms and ransoms."
A roar of outrage drowned out his voice.
"Craven!"
the Great John thundered.
"Begging for a truce will make us seem weak," declared Lady Mormont.
"Ransoms be damned, we must not give up the Kingslayer," shouted Rickard Carstock.
"Why not a peace?" Catelyn asked. The lords looked at her, but it was Rob's eyes she felt, his and his alone. "My lady, they murdered my lord father, your husband," he said grimly. He unsheathed his longsword and laid it on the table before him, the bright steel on the rough wood. "This is the only peace I have for Lannisters." The Great John bellowed his approval, and other men added their voices, shouting and drawing swords and pounding their fists on the table. Catelyn waited until they had quieted. "My lords," she said then, "Lord Eddard was your liege, but I shared his bed. I bore his children. Do you think I love him any less than you?" Her voice almost broke with her grief. But Catelyn took a long breath and steadied herself. "Rob, if that sword could bring him back, I should never let you sheathe it until Ned stood at my side once more. But he is gone, and 100 Whispering Woods will not change that. Ned is gone, and Darren Hornwood and Lord Carstark's valiant sons, and many other good men besides. And none of them will return to us. Must we have more deaths still?"
"You are a woman, my lady," the great John rumbled in his deep voice. "Women do not understand these things."
"You are the gentle sex," said Lord Carstark, with the lines of grief fresh on his face. "A man has a need for vengeance. Give me Cersei Lannister, Lord Carstark, and you would see how gentle a woman can be," Catelyn replied. "Perhaps I do not understand tactics and strategy, but I understand futility. We went to war when Lannister armies were ravaging the Riverlands, and Ned was a prisoner, falsely accused of treason. We fought to defend ourselves and to win my lord's freedom. Well, the one is done, and the other forever beyond our reach. I will mourn for Ned until the end of my days, but I must think of the living. I want my daughters back, and the queen holds them still. If I must trade our 4 Lannisters for their 2 Starks, I will call that a bargain and thank the gods. I want you safe, Rob, ruling at Winterfell from your father's seat. I want you to live your life to kiss a girl and wed a woman and father a son. I want to write an end to this. I want to go home, my lords, and weep for my husband." The hall was very quiet when Catelyn finished speaking.
"Peace," said her uncle Brynden. "Peace is sweet, my lady, but on what terms? It's no good hammering your sword into a ploughshare if you must forge it again on the morrow."
"What did Turin and my Eddard die for, if I am to return to Carhold with nothing but their bones?" asked Rickard Carstark.
"I," said Lord Bracken, "Gregor Clegane, laid waste to my fields, slaughtered my small folk, and left Stonehenge a smoking ruin. Am I now to bend the knee to the ones who sent him? What have we fought for, if we are to put all back as it was before?"
Lord Blackwood agreed, to Catelyn's surprise and dismay.
"And if we do make peace with King Joffrey, are we not then traitorous to King Renly? What if the stag should prevail against the lion? Where would that leave us?"
"Whatever you may decide for yourselves, I shall never call a Lannister my king," declared Mark Piper.
"Nor I," yelled the little Derry boy. "I never will."
Again the shouting began. Catelyn sat despairing. She had come so close, she thought. They had almost listened. Almost. But the moment was gone. There would be no peace, no chance to heal, no safety. She looked at her son, watched him as he listened to the lord's debate, frowning, troubled, yet wedded to his war. He had pledged himself to marry a daughter of Walder Frey, but she saw his true bride plain before her now, the sword he had laid on the table. Catelyn was thinking of her girls, wondering if she would ever see them again, when the great John lurched to his feet.
"My lords," he shouted, his voice booming off the rafters. "Here is what I say to these 2 kings." He spat. "Renly Baratheon is nothing to me, nor Stannis neither. Why should they rule over me and mine from some flowery seat in Highgarden or Dorne? What do they know of the Wall or the Wolf's Wood or the Barrows of the First Men? Even their guards are wrong. The others take the Lannisters too. I've had a bellyful of them."
He reached back over his shoulder and drew his immense two-handed greatsword.
"Why shouldn't we rule ourselves again? It was the dragons we married, and the dragons are all dead."
He pointed at Rub with a blade.
"There sits the only king I mean to bow my knee to, my lords,"
he thundered.
"The king in the north."
And he knelt and laid his sword at her son's feet.
"I'll have peace on those terms," Lord Carstark said. "They can keep their red castle and their iron chair as well."
He eased his longsword from its scabbard.
"The king in the north," he said,
kneeling beside the great John. Mage Mormont rose.
"The king of winter,"
she declared, and laid her spike mace beside the swords. And the river lords were rising too, Blackwood and Bracken and Malister, houses who had never been ruled from Winterfell. Yet Catelyn watched them rise and draw their blades, bending their knees and shouting the old words that had not been heard in the realm for more than 300 years, since Aegon the Dragon had come to make the Seven Kingdoms one, yet now were heard again, ringing from the timbers of her father's hall. "The king in the north! The king in the north! The king in the north!"
Daenerys. Dany broke her fast under the persimmon tree that grew in the terrace garden, watching her dragons chase each other about the apex of the Great Pyramid, where the huge bronze harpy once stood. Meereen had a score of lesser pyramids, but none stood even half as tall. From here she could see the whole city, the narrow, twisting alleys and wide brick streets, the temples and granaries, hovels and palaces, brothels and bars, gardens and fountains, the great red circles of the fighting pits. And beyond the walls was the Pewter Sea, the whining Skahazadan, the dry brown hills, burnt orchards, and blackened fields. Up here in her garden, Dany sometimes felt like a god, living atop the highest mountain in the world. Do all gods feel so lonely? Some must, surely. Missandei had told her of the Lord of Harmony, worshipped by the peaceful people of Naith. He was the only true god, her little scribe said, the god who always was and always would be, who made the moon and stars and earth and all the creatures that dwelt upon them. Poor Lord of Harmony. Dany pitied him. It must be terrible to be alone for all time, attended by hordes of butterfly women you could make or unmake at a word. Westeros had 7 guards at least, though Viserys had told her that some septons said the 7 were only aspects of a single god, 7 facets of a single crystal. That was just confusing. The Red Priests believed in 2 gods, she had heard, but 2 who were eternally at war. Dany liked that even less. She would not want to be eternally at war. Missandei served her duck eggs and dog sausage, and 1/2 cup of sweetened wine mixed with the juice of a lime. The honey drew flies, but a scented candle drove them off. The flies were not so troublesome up here as they were in the rest of her city, she had found. Something else she liked about the pyramid. "I must remember to do something about the flies," Dany said. "Are there many flies on Naith, Missandei?"
"On Naith, there are butterflies,"
the scribe responded in the common tongue.
"More a wine?"
"No, I must hold court soon." Dany had grown very fond of Missandei. The little scribe with the big golden eyes was wise beyond her years. She is brave as well. She had to be, to survive the life she's lived. One day she hoped to see this fabled isle of Naith. Missandei said the peaceful people made music instead of war. They did not kill, not even animals. They ate only fruit and never flesh. The butterfly spirits, sacred to their Lord of Harmony, protected their isle against those who would do them harm. Many conquerors had sailed on Naith to blood their swords, only to sicken and die. The butterflies do not help them when the slave ships come raiding, though. "I'm going to take you home one day, Missandei," Dany promised. If I had made the same promise to Jorah,
would he still have sold me? I swear it.
This one is content to stay with you, your grace. A knight will be there always. You are good to this, to me.
And you to me. Danny took the girl by the hand. Come help me dress. Jiqui helped Miss Andy bathe her, while Iri was laying out her clothes. Today she wore a robe of purple samite and a silver sash, and on her head the three-headed dragon crown the Tourmaline Brotherhood had given her in Karth. Her slippers were silver as well, with heels so high she was always half afraid she was about to topple over. When she was dressed, Miss Andy brought her a polished silver glass so she could see how she looked. Danny stared at herself in silence. Is this the face of a conqueror? So far as she could tell, she still looked like a little girl. No one was calling her Daenerys the Conqueror yet, but perhaps they would. Aegon the Conqueror had won Westeros with three dragons, but she had taken Meereen with sewer rats and a wooden cock in less than a day. Poor Grolio. He still grieved for his ship, she knew. If a war galley could ram another ship, why not a gate? That had been her thought when she commanded the captains to drive their ships ashore. Their masts had become her battering rams, and swarms of freedmen had torn their hulls apart to build mantlets, turtles, catapults, and ladders. The sellswords had given each ram a bawdy name, and it had been the mainmast of Meraxes, formerly Joso's prank, that had broken the eastern gate. Joso's cock, they called it. The fighting had raged bitter and bloody for most of a day, and well into the night, before the wood began to splinter, and Meraxes' iron figurehead, a laughing jester's face, came crashing through. Danny had wanted to lead the attack herself, but to a man her captain said that would be madness, and her captains never agreed on anything. Instead, she remained in the rear, sitting atop her silver in a long shirt of mail. She heard the city fall from half a league away, though, when the defenders' shouts of defiance changed to cries of fear. Her dragons had roared as one in that moment, filling the night with flames. The slaves are rising, she knew at once. My sewer rats have gnawed off their chains. When the last resistance had been crushed by the Unsullied and the sack had run its course, Danny entered her city. The dead were heaped so high before the broken gate that it took her freedmen nearly an hour to make a path for her silver. Joso's cock and the great wooden turtle that had protected it, covered with horse hides, lay abandoned within. She rode past burned buildings and broken windows, through brick streets where the gutters were choked with the stiff and swollen dead. Cheering slaves lifted blood-stained hands to her as she went by and called her Mother. In the plaza before the Great Pyramid, the Myronese huddled forlorn. The great masters had looked anything but great in the morning light. Stripped of their jewels and their fringed tokars, they were contemptible, a herd of old men with shriveled balls and spotted skin, and young men with ridiculous hair. Their women were either soft and fleshy or as dry as old sticks, their face paint streaked by tears. "I want your leaders," Danny told them. "Give them up, and the rest of you shall be spared."
"How many?" an old woman had asked, sobbing. "How many must you have to spare us?"
163, she answered. She had them nailed to wooden posts around the plaza, each man pointing at the next. The anger was fierce and hot inside her when she gave the command. It made her feel like an avenging dragon. But later, when she passed the men dying on the posts, when she heard their moans and smelled their bowels and blood, Danny put the glass aside, frowning. It was just. It was. I did it for the children. Her audience chamber was on the level below, an echoing, high-ceilinged room with walls of purple marble. It was a chilly place for all its grandeur. There had been a throne there, a fantastic thing of carved and gilded wood in the shape of a savage harpy. She had taken one long look and commanded it to be broken up for firewood. "I will not sit in the harpy's lap," she told them. Instead, she sat upon a simple ebony bench. It served, though she heard the Myrnes muttering that it did not befit a queen. Her blood riders were waiting for her. Silver bells tinkled in their oiled braids, and they wore the gold and jewels of dead men. Maureen had been rich beyond imagining. Even her sellsword seemed sated, at least for now. Across the room, Grey Worm wore the plain uniform of the Unsullied, his spiked bronze cap beneath one arm. These, at least, she could rely on, or so she hoped. And Brown Ben Plum as well. Solid Ben, with his grey-white hair and weathered face so beloved of her dragons. And Dario beside him, glittering in gold. Dario and Ben Plum, Grey Worm, Iri, Jiqui, Missandei. As she looked at them, Danny found herself wondering which of them would betray her next. The dragon has three heads. There are two men in the world who I can trust, if I can find them. I will not be alone then. We will be three against the world, like Aegon and his sisters. Was the night as quiet as it seemed? Danny asked.
It seems it was, Your Grace, said Brown Ben Plum.
She was pleased. Maureen had been sacked savagely, as new fallen cities always were, but Danny was determined that should end now that the city was hers. She had decreed that murderers were to be hanged, that looters were to lose a hand, and rapists their manhood. Eight killers swung from the walls, and the Unsullied had filled a bushel basket with bloody hands and soft red worms. But Maureen was calm again. But for how long? A fly buzzed her head. Danny waved it off, irritated. But it returned almost at once. There are too many flies in this city. Ben Plum gave a bark of laughter.
There were flies in my ale this morning. I swallowed one of them.
Flies are the dead man's revenge, Dario smiled and stroked the centre prong of his beard.
Corpses breed maggots, and maggots breed flies.
We will rid ourselves of the corpses, then, starting with those in the plaza below. Grey Worm, will you see to it?
The Queen commands, these ones obey.
Best bring sacks, as well as shovels, Worm, Brown Ben counselled. Well past ripe, those ones, falling off those poles in bits and pieces and crawling with...
He knows, so do I. Danny remembered the horror she had felt when she had seen the Plaza of Punishment in Astapor. I made a horror just as great, but surely they deserved it. Harsh justice is still justice.
A glass, said Missandei. Guess Harley enter their hundred dead in crypts below their manses. If you would boil their bones clean and return them to their kin, it would be a kindness.
The widows will curse me all the same.
Let it be done. Danny beckoned Dario. How many seek audience this morning?
To have presented themselves to bask in your radiance.
Dario had planted himself a whole new wardrobe in Maureen, and to match it he had re-dyed his tritoned beard and curly hair a deep, rich purple. It made his eyes look almost purple, too, as if he were some lost Valyrian.
They arrived in the night on the Indigo Star, a trading galley out of Karth.
A slaver, you mean? Danny frowned. Who are they?
The Star's master, and one who claims to speak for Astapor.
I will see the envoy first. He proved to be a pale, ferret-faced man, with ropes of pearls and spun gold hanging heavy about his neck.
Your worship, he cried. My name is Gal. I bring greetings to the Mother of Dragons from King Cleon of Astapor, Cleon the Great.
Danny stiffened. I left a council to rule Astapor, a healer, a scholar, and a priest.
Your worship, those sly rogues betrayed your trust. It was revealed that they were scheming to restore the good masters to power and the people to chains. great Cleon expose their plots and hack their heads off with a cleaver, and the grateful folk of Astapor have crowned him for his valor.
A noble girl, said Missandei in the dialect of Astapor, is this the same Cleon once owned by Glasdan Mor Ulhur?
Her voice was guileless, yet the question plainly made the envoy anxious.
The same, he admitted, a great man.
Missandei leaned closer to Danny. He was a butcher in Glasdan's kitchen, the girl whispered in her ear. It is said he could slaughter a pig faster than any man in Astapor.
I have given Astapor a butcher king?
Danny felt ill, but she knew she must not let the envoy see it. I will pray that King Cleon rules well and wisely. What would he have of me?
Garl rubbed his mouth.
Perhaps we shall speak more privily, your grace.
I have no secrets from my captains and commanders.
As you wish. Grey Cleon bids me declare his devotion to the Mother of Dragons. Your enemies are his enemies, he says. And chief among them are the wise masters of Yankai. He proposes a pact between Astapor and Meereen against the Yankai.
I swore no harm would come to Yankai if they released their slaves, said Danny.
These Yankish dogs cannot be trusted, your worship. Even now they plot against you. New levies have been raised and can be seen drilling outside the city walls. Warships are being built. Envoys have been sent to New Gis and Valentus in the west to make alliances and hire sellswords. They have even dispatched riders to Vaes Dothrak to bring a Khalasar down upon you. Great Cleon bid me tell you not to be afraid. Astapor remembers. Astapor will not forsake you. To prove his faith, Great Cleon offers to seal your alliance with a marriage.
A marriage? To me? Garl smiled. His teeth were brown and rotten.
Great Cleon will give you many strong sons.
Danny found herself bereft of words, but little Missandei came to her rescue. Oh, did his first wife give him sons? The envoy looked at her unhappily.
Grey Cleon has three daughters by his first wife. Two of his newer wives are with child, but he means to put all of them aside if the Mother of Dragons will consent to wed him.
How noble of him, said Danny. I will consider all you said, my lord. She gave orders that Garl be given chambers for the night somewhere lower in the pyramid. All my victories turn to dross in my hands, she thought. Whatever I do, all I make is death and horror. When word of what had befallen Astapor reached the streets, as it surely would, tens of thousands of newly freed Meereenese slaves would doubtless decide to follow her when she went west, for fear of what awaited them if they stayed. Yet it might well be that worse would await them on the march. Even if she emptied every granary in the city and left Meereen to starve, how could she feed so many? The way before her was fraught with hardship, bloodshed, and danger. Sir Jorah had warned her of that. He'd warned her of so many things. No, I will not think of Jorah Mormont. Let him keep a little longer. I shall see this trader captain, she announced. Perhaps he would have some better tidings. That proved to be a forlorn hope. The master of the Indigo Star was Cathin, so he wept copiously when asked about Astapor.
The city bleeds. Dead men rot unburied in the streets. Its pyramid is an armed camp, and the markets have neither food nor slaves for sale. And the poor children, King Cleaver's thugs have seized every high-born boy in Astapor to make new unsullied for the trade, though it will be years before they are trained.
The thing that surprised Danny most was how unsurprised she was. She found herself remembering Eroa,
the Lazarine girl she had once tried to protect, and what had happened to her. It will be the same in Marine once I march, she thought. The slaves from the fighting pits, bred and trained to slaughter, were already proving themselves unruly and quarrelsome. They seemed to think they owned the city now, and every man and woman in it. Two of them had been among the 8 she'd hanged. There is no more I can do, she told herself. What do you want of me, Captain?
Slaves, he said. My holds are full to bursting with ivory, ambergris, zorse hides, and other fine goods. I would trade them here for slaves to sell in Lys and Valantis.
We have no slaves for sale, said Danny.
My queen,
Dario stepped forward.
The riverside is full of Marinese, begging leave to be allowed to sell themselves to this Cathin. They are thicker than the flies.
Danny was shocked. They want to be slaves?
The ones who come are well-spoken and gently born, sweet queen. Such slaves are prized. In the free cities they will be tutors, scribes, bed-slaves, even healers and priests. They will sleep in soft beds, eat rich foods, and dwell in manses. Here they have lost all, and live in fear and squalor.
I see. Perhaps it was not so shocking if these tales of Astapor were true. Danny thought a moment. Any man who wishes to sell himself into slavery may do so, or woman. She raised a hand. But they may not sell their children, nor a man his wife.
In Astapor, the city took a tenth part of the price each time a slave changed hands,
Missandei told her. We'll do the same, Danny decided. Wars were won with gold as much as swords. A tenth part in gold or silver coin or ivory. Marine has no need of saffron, cloves, or zorse hides.
It shall be done as you command, glorious queen, said Dario. My storm crows will collect your tenth.
If the storm crows saw to the collections, at least half the gold would somehow go astray, Danny knew. But the second sons were just as bad, and the unsolid were as unlettered as they were incorruptible. Records must be kept, she said. Seek among the freedmen for men who can read, write, and do sums. His business done, the captain of the Indigo Star bowed and took his leave. Danny shifted uncomfortably on the ebony bench. She dreaded what must come next, yet she knew she had put it off too long already. Yunkai and Astapor, threats of war, marriage proposals, the march west looming over all. I need my knights, I need their swords, and I need their counsel. Yet the thought of seeing Jorah Mormont again made her feel as if she'd swallowed a spoonful of flies, angry, agitated, sick. She could almost feel them buzzing around her belly. I am the blood of the dragon. I must be strong. I must have fire in my eyes when I face them, not tears. Tell Belwas to bring my knights, Danny commanded, before she could change her mind. My good knights. Strong Belwas was puffing from the climb when he marched them through the doors, one meaty hand wrapped tight around each man's arm. Sir Barristan walked with his head held high, but Sir Jorah stared at the marble floor as he approached. The one is proud, the other guilty. The old man had shaved off his white beard. He looked 10 years younger without it, but her balding bear looked older than he had. They halted before the bench. Strong Belwas stepped back and stood with his arms crossed across his scarred chest. Sir Jorah cleared his throat.
Khaleesi?
She had missed his voice so much, but she had to be stern. Be quiet. I will tell you when to speak. She stood. When I sent you down into the sewers, part of me hoped I'd seen the last of you. It seemed a fitting end for liars to drown in slavers' filth. I thought the guards would deal with you, but instead you returned to me. My gallant knights of Westeros, an informer and a turncloak. My brother would have hanged you both.
Viserys would have, anyway. She did not know what Rhaegar would have done.
I will admit you helped me win this city. Sir Jorah's mouth tightened. "We won you, this city. We saw rats." "Be quiet," she said again, though there was truth to what he said. While Jozo's cock and the other rams were battering the city gates, and her archers were firing flights of flaming arrows over the walls, Danny had sent 200 men along the river under cover of darkness to fire the hulks in the harbour. But that was only to hide their true purpose. As the flaming ships drew the eyes of the defenders on the walls, a few half-mad swimmers found the sewer mouths and pried loose a rusted iron grating. Sir Jorah, Sir Barristan, Strong Belwas, and 20 brave fools slipped beneath the brown water and up the brick tunnel, a mixed force of sellswords, unsullied, and freedmen. Danny had told them to choose only men who had no families, and preferably no sense of smell. They had been lucky as well as brave. It had been a moon's turn since the last good rain, and the sewers were only thigh high. The oilcloth they had wrapped around their torches kept them dry, so they had light. A few of the freedmen were frightened of the huge rats until Strong Belwas caught one and bit it in two. One man was killed by a great pale lizard that reared up out of the dark water to drag him off by the leg, but when next ripples were spied, Sir Jorah butchered the beast with his blade. They took some wrong turnings, but once they found the surface, Strong Belwas led them to the nearest fighting pit, where they surprised a few guards and struck the chains off the slaves. Within an hour, half the fighting slaves and marine had risen. "You helped win this city," she repeated stubbornly, "and you have served me well in the past. Sir Barristan saved me from the Titan's bastard and from the sorrowful man in Karth. Sir Jorah saved me from the poisoner in Vase Dothrak, and again from Drogo's blood riders after my sun and stars had died." So many people wanted her dead. Sometimes she lost count. "And yet you lied, deceived me, betrayed me." She turned to Sir Barristan. "You protected my father for many years, fought beside my brother on the Trident, but you abandoned Viserys in his exile and bent your knee to the usurper instead. Why? And tell it true."
"Some truths are hard to hear. Robert was a good knight, chivalrous, brave. He spared my life and the lives of many others. Prince Viserys was only a boy. It would have been years before he was fit to rule. And, forgive me, my queen, but you ask for truth. Even as a child, your brother Viserys oft seemed to be his father's son, in ways that Rhaegar never did."
"His father's son?" Danny frowned. "What does that mean?" The old knight did not blink.
"Your father is called the Mad King in Westeros. Has no one ever told you?"
"Viserys did. The Mad King. The usurper called him that. The usurper and his dogs." "The Mad King?" "It was a lie."
"Why ask for truth?" Sir Barristan said softly. "If you will close your ears to it."
He hesitated, then continued.
"I told you before that I used a false name, so the Lannisters would not know that I joined you. That was less than half of it, Your Grace. The truth is, I wanted to watch you for a time before pledging you my sword, to make certain that you were not..."
"My father's daughter?" If she was not her father's daughter, who was she?
"Mad," he finished. "But I see no taint in you."
"Taint?" Danny bristled.
"I am no maester to quote history at you, Your Grace. Swords have been my life, not books. But every child knows that the Targaryens have always danced too close to madness. Your father was not the first. King Jaehaerys once told me that madness and greatness are two sides of the same coin. Every time a new Targaryen is born, he said, the gods toss the coin in the air, and the world holds its breath to see how it will land."
"Jaehaerys? This old man knew my grandfather?" The thought gave her pause. Most of what she knew of Westeros had come from her brother, and the rest from Sir Jorah. Sir Barristan would have forgotten more than the two of them had ever known. This man can tell me what I came from. So I am a coin in the hands of some god. Is that what you're saying, sir?
No,
Sir Barristan replied. You are the true-born heir of Westeros. To the end of my days, I shall remain your faithful knight. Should you find me worthy to bear a sword again? If not, I am content to serve Strong Belwas as his squire.
What if I decide you're only worthy to be my fool? Danny asked scornfully. Or perhaps my cook?
I would be honored, Your Grace,
Selmy said with quiet dignity.
I can bake apples and boil beef as well as any man, and I've roasted many a duck over a campfire. I hope you like them greasy, with charred skin and bloody bones.
That made her smile. I'd have to be mad to eat such fare. Ben Plum, come, give Sir Barristan your longsword. But Whitebeard would not take it.
I've flung my sword at Joffrey's feet, and have not touched one since. Only from the hand of my queen will I accept a sword again.
As you wish. Danny took the sword from Brown Ben and offered it, hilt first. The old man took it reverently. Now kneel, she told him, and swear it to my service. He went to one knee and laid the blade before her as he said the words. Danny scarcely heard them. He was the easy one, she thought. The other will be harder. When Sir Barristan was done, she turned to Jorah Mormont. And now you, sir, tell me true. The big man's neck was red, whether from anger or shame she did not know.
I have tried to tell you true 50 times. I told you Arstan was more than he seemed. I warned you that Zaro and Pyat Pree were not to be trusted. I warned you.
You warned me against everyone except yourself. His insolence angered her. He should be humbler. He should beg for my forgiveness. Trust no one but Jorah Mormont, you said, and all the time you were the spider's creature.
I'm no man's creature. I took the eunuch's gold, yes. I learned some ciphers and wrote some letters, but that was all.
All? You spied on me and sold me to my enemies.
For a time,
he said it grudgingly.
I stopped.
When? When did you stop?
I made one report from Carth, but...
From Carth? Danny had been hoping it had ended much earlier. What did you write from Carth? That you were my man now? That you wanted no more of their schemes?
Sir Jorah could not meet her eyes.
When Khal Drogo died, you asked me to go with you to Yi Ti and the Jade Sea. Was that your wish? Or Roberts?
That was to protect you, he insisted, to keep you away from them. I knew what snakes they were.
Snakes? And what are you, sir? Something unspeakable occurred to her. You told them I was carrying Drogo's child,
Khaleesi. Do not think to deny it, sir,
Sir Barristan said sharply.
I was there when the eunuch told the council, and Robert decreed that Her Grace and her child must die. You were the source, sir. There was even talk that you might do the deed for a pardon.
A lie, Sir Jorah's face darkened.
I would never, Daenerys. It was me who stopped you from drinking the wine.
Yes, and how was it you knew the wine was poisoned?
I but suspected. The caravan brought a letter from Varys. He warned me there would be attempts. He wanted you watched, yes, but not harmed.
He went to his knees.
If I had not told them, someone else would have. You know that.
I know that you betrayed me. She touched her belly where her son Rhaego had perished. I know a poisoner tried to kill my son because of you. That's what I know.
No, no.
He shook his head.
I never meant... Forgive me. You have to forgive me.
Have to? It was too late. He should have begun by begging forgiveness. She could not pardon him as she'd intended.
She had dragged the wine cellar behind her horse until there was nothing left of him. Didn't the man who brought him deserve the same? This is Jorah, my fierce bear, the right arm that never failed me. I would be dead without him, but... I can't forgive you, she said. I can't. You forgave the old man? He lied to me about his name. You sold my secrets to the men who killed my father and stole my brother's throne. I protected you. I fought for you, killed for you. Kissed me, she thought, betrayed me. I went down into the sores like a rat for you. It might have been kinder if you'd died there. Danny said nothing. There was nothing to say. Daenerys, he said, I have loved you. And there it was. Three treasons, you will know, once for blood, and once for gold, and once for love. The guards do nothing without a purpose, they say. You did not die in battle, so it must be they still have some use for you. But I don't. I will not have you near me. You are banished, sir. Go back to your masters in King's Landing, and collect your pardon, if you can, or to Astapor. No doubt the Butcher King needs knights. No, he reached for her. Daenerys, please hear me. She slapped his hand away. Do not ever presume to touch me again, or to speak my name. You have until dawn to collect your things and leave the city. If you are found in Meereen past break of day, I will have Strong Belwas twist your head off. I will. Believe that. She turned her back on him, her skirt swirling. I cannot bear to see his face. Remove this liar from my sight, she commanded. I must not weep. I must not. If I weep, I will forgive him. Strong Belwas seized Ser Jorah by the arm and dragged him out. When Danny glanced back, the knight was walking as if drunk, stumbling and slow. She looked away until she heard the doors open and close. Then she sank back onto the ebony bench. He's gone, then. My father and my mother, my brothers, Sir Willem Dary, Drogo, who was my son and stars, his son, who died inside me, and now Ser Jorah.
The Queen has a good heart,
Dario purred through his deep purple whiskers.
But that one is more dangerous than all the Asnaks and Merrows rolled up in one.
His strong hands caressed the hilts of his matched blades, those wanton golden women.
You need not even say the word, my radiance. Only give the tiniest nod, and your Dario shall fetch you back his ugly head.
Leave him be. The scales are balanced now. Let him go home. Danny pictured Jorah moving amongst old gnarled oaks and tall pines, past flowering thorn bushes, grey stones bearded with moss, and little creeks running icy down the steep hillsides. She saw him entering a hall built of huge logs, where dogs slept by the hearth, and the smell of meat and mead hung thick in the smoky air. "We are done for now," she told her captains. It was all she could do not to run back up the wide marble stairs. Iri helped her slip from her court clothes and into more comfortable garb. Baggy woolen breeches, a loose felted tunic, a painted Dothraki vest. "You are trembling, Khaleesi," the girl said as she knelt to lace up Danny's sandals. "I'm cold," Danny lied. "Bring me the book I was reading last night." She wanted to lose herself in the words, in other times and other places. The fat, leather-bound volume was full of songs and stories from the Seven Kingdoms. Children's stories, if truth be told, too simple and fanciful to be true history. All the heroes were tall and handsome, and you could tell the traitors by their shifty eyes. Yet she loved them all the same. Last night she had been reading of the three princesses in the Red Tower, locked away by the king for the crime of being beautiful. When her handmaid brought the book, Danny had no trouble finding the page where she had left off, but it was no good. She found herself reading the same passage half a dozen times. Sir Jorah gave me this book as a bride's gift the day I wed Khal Drogo. But Dario is right.